Please be seated. Well, my notes tell me that we have some folks from Stockbridge High School. If that's the case, would you all please stand? Oh, wow, wonderful. Thank you. Please be seated. The students are here on a program that we run called Court with Class, so they know a little bit about the case that is going to be argued before the court today. If you all have time, students, to stay, and anyone else who'd like to as well, Justice Rebecca Bradley, who's right down here, will come and visit with you after the conclusion of the argument and tell you a little bit about how cases get to the Supreme Court and answer some questions for you. She won't be talking about the merits of the case, but if you choose to stay, I'm sure you'll find it interesting. Okay, our second case of the morning, OLR versus Nora. Are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Please do.
Good morning. I am pleased to appear before this court once again. I was last here on November 7th, 2017, for the oral argument in what has been referred to as Nora 1. This I will refer to as Nora 2. There is a mistaken perception that the residential foreclosure crisis is over. Citizens of the state of Wisconsin are still being subjected to forfeiture of their homes based on false pleadings, false documents authenticated by falsely sworn affidavits. Thousands of Wisconsin citizens have lost their homes since 2008 or are currently facing the imminent loss of their homes. Over 6 million homes have been foreclosed nationwide since 2008. Many of the foreclosures have involved false documents. When I appeared before this court for oral argument in Nora 1, I informed the court I had hoped to be able to appear before this court in its original jurisdiction to address issues of serious concern arising from the residential foreclosure crisis. At that time, I decided that I should call the court's attention to the due process rights that I believed I had been deprived of in Nora 1.
Now, counsel, we are going to hear only arguments relative to Nora 2, so please confine your comments to the case before us.
Yes, Your Honor.
Decided Nora 1.
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, which has been referred to as Nora 2, OLR first sought to bring the allegations set forth in the five counts in this second amended complaint in Nora 2 in Nora 1. But the case was bifurcated and Nora 2 was assigned to a different referee. The bifurcation of Nora 1 and Nora 2 resulted in orders by the referee in Nora 2, which I contend prevented me from relying on the proceedings in Nora 1 as part of my defense to OLR's alleged selective and vindictive prosecution of me. This court has denied my motion to vacate based on discovery of new evidence, and we are now proceeding in the Nora 2 case where I wanted to defend my conduct based on my representation of clients, which involved similar issues to the representation I engaged in defense of my own home as a test case in Nora 2, Nora 1, for which I have been disciplined. Unlike the case that was argued earlier this morning, there are a number of issues which arise in this case. First of all, the issue which this court should decide in the interest of clarifying the application of SCR 20:3.1A in pleadings and practice in disciplinary actions is whether the referee's recommendations that counts 1 and 4 be dismissed on due process grounds. I have reserved the following issues for future proceedings, whether chapters 21 and 22 are unconstitutional as applied to me, whether I was denied due process and equal protection of the laws by proceedings on final determination of my motion to dismiss in NORA 2, which is a dispositive motion decided by an unelected referee, in which I believe is contrary to this court's holding in Universal Processing Services of Wisconsin versus Circuit Court of Milwaukee, a 2017 case. I can provide the complete citation if the court wishes. The issues I would also like to address is whether I was denied due process by the filing of a second amended complaint without review by a preliminary review panel of the preliminary review committee and without their approval, which ultimately led to the preclusion of my right to produce witnesses and evidence in my defense, contrary to State versus Hirsch, 73 Wis. 2nd, 390, 1976.
Counsel, as I read your arguments, I found the argument about SCR 2211 interesting. It's not one I'd heard before. As I went back and reviewed the citation, it talks about initiation of proceedings. But there's your complaint is that a complaint, which you do not argue was not properly brought before the preliminary review committee, was amended. But what you cite to us talks about initiation of the proceedings. So the proceedings weren't initiated by the second amended complaint. It was just an amendment of the first complaint, which did initiate the proceedings, correct?
Actually, Your Honor, that's not how I see the record. I always challenge from the very beginning whether the preliminary review committee had actually approved the allegations that initiated the complaint.
Okay, well, your matter was before the PRE, before the complaint was filed. Do you agree with that?
I'm sorry, please repeat.
The matter that began this proceeding, the initial complaint, that the matter had been before the preliminary review commission before the initial complaint was filed.
In NORA 2?
Yes, in this action that we're talking about, right?
Actually, Your Honor, NORA 2 was initiated as a second amended complaint in NORA 1, which was bifurcated. And so there is no evidence in the record that the preliminary review committee or the panel of the preliminary review committee actually heard and determined the allegations in the second amended complaint that was initiated in NORA 1.
Okay, the proceedings in NORA 1 and NORA 2 were bifurcated into two parts. Is that what you're telling me?
The attempted second amended complaint in NORA 1 involved the 5 counts that were bifurcated and then preceded by the second amended ultimately the second amended complaint in NORA 2. There was a complaint which was taken from the second amended complaint in NORA 1 and pleaded as NORA 2. And then that complaint was amended and ultimately a second amended complaint was allowed to be filed in NORA 2.
Right, but it is the amended complaint that you're complaining about, but the section of the SCR talks about initiation of the proceeding. But it wasn't the second amended complaint that initiated this proceeding.
No, the second amended complaint in NORA 1 first initiated the proceeding that became NORA 2 when I moved to not have that case that was the second amended complaint in NORA 1 heard because we were close to hearing in NORA 1.
Right. I just am trying to be sure that I understand your argument, but what you're complaining about is the second amended complaint filed August 18, 2016, correct?
I'm complaining about the entire proceedings
okay. Well,
in
we're looking
Nora
at SCR 2211, initiation of the proceedings. You cite that section for an objection to the second amended complaint, correct?
I do, because that requires probable cause to be determined.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I think we're talking past each other, but that's fine.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. My issue is that there was no probable cause for Nora 2 at all.
There was probable cause for Nora 1 at the outset, but then there was an amended complaint, and there was a second amended complaint in Nora 1. What do you contest that there was no probable cause in Nora 1 for the second amended complaint?
Yes.
That's what I thought, yeah.
Another issue that I think is very critical to have the court determine is the length of the suspension that is being recommended by the referee. My entire course of conduct in Nora 1 and Nora 2 was directed toward the defense of Wisconsin homes against foreclosures based on false documents. What the referee has recommended is 2 years additional suspension to Nora 1. My suspension in Nora 1 went into effect on April 30th, 2018. The referee is recommending an additional 2 years, stating that I am a danger to the public. I have researched the concept of being a danger to the public, which I don't think I am, and that mostly has been addressed on reinstatement, and it has involved disability issues, which had to be medically cleared before reinstatement. I did suffer a head injury during the course of the proceedings in Nora 2, but it did affect my performance on the third day of the hearing, where I became fatigued and didn't express myself as well as I had hoped, having reviewed the transcript. But it is not supported in the record that I am a danger to the public on the basis of this alleged conduct, because my position is that I was following the law, alleging facts that I could prove, and trying to defend the homes of my clients, Ms. Spencer and the Rinaldis. Then there's a costs issue, which kind of dovetails with this morning's other hearing on the reasonableness of costs, and I have to implore the court to take a close look at SCR 22.24 and how that has been not complied with in this case. I objected to OLR's request for cost, first of all, as to whether or not the costs being proposed to be assessed are subject to the automatic stay in my Chapter 13 case in the United States Bankruptcy Court for the District of Minnesota, but also whether or not the costs are being imposed unconstitutionally. And again, I will direct the Court's attention to the excellent language in universal processing, and I'm going to give that full citation now for the record, Universal Processing Services of Wisconsin versus Circuit Court of Milwaukee County, 374 Wisconsin 2nd, 26 and 892 Northwest 2nd, 267 Wisconsin 2017. That case at paragraph 98 notes, the cost of litigation can price people out of the constitutionally established state judicial system. Yet justice should be available to all persons regardless of financial means. The Wisconsin Constitution embodies the principles that the courts are an essential and integral part of Wisconsin's government, open to the people, and the cost thereof is borne as a public expense. And the universal processing case refers to Article 1, Section 9 of the Wisconsin Constitution, which states that justice should be available freely and should freely and without cost. Now, the appointment of a private referee at cost to the lawyer in a disciplinary proceeding can indeed have this chilling effect on the defense that a lawyer would be able to bring. Furthermore, the OLR's untimely itemization of costs filed on October 1st, 2018 deprived me of the due process right to contest the reasonableness of the costs. According to my research, the suspension recommended for an additional 1 year consecutive to Nora 1 results in the longest suspension this court has ever imposed on a lawyer short of disbarment, and I beseech your honors not to consider my zealous defense of homeowners to be a disbarrable offense. But let's look at if I had some performance deficits in terms of my articulation of my client's issues or the forums I chose to proceed to defend those homes were in any way defective. It's not for want of my research or my intention to comply with statutes and rules. It was my interpretation of how to proceed. And the five counts involve two counts of violation of SCR 20:3.2A, which has three subparts, which were not articulated as to what conduct supported any of those three subsections, which is why the referee found that counts 1 and 4 should be dismissed as a due process violation. But I also have a concern that there's a proposal to discipline me for delay in those two cases when, in fact, if there's no actual delay, as I documented in my briefs, and it certainly wasn't my intention to delay, but only to provide my clients with the venue and the process to which they are due before they can forfeit something as important as the family home. And then the issue of whether I violated my oath is very painful for me, because I take my oath very seriously, as all lawyers should. And OLR, in its footnote 3 of the second amended complaint, excerpted certain language from SCR 40.15 and seems to focus on the notion that I disrespect courts of justice and judicial officers. That's the first part of what they have excerpted. I will maintain the respect due to courts of justice and judicial officers. I have great remorse for any inappropriate articulation of my concerns about Judge Potter's conduct of the Spencer matter and Judge Crabb's previous denial of my ADA request in another matter. And
Ms. Nora, could I take, I'm afraid I don't understand the due process challenge that you're making, and I want to make sure that I understand the timeline that you're talking about.
Sure.
So we have what we're referring to as Nora 1 and Nora 2. Nora 1 is case number 13 AP 653.
Yes.
Right? Okay. And this is Nora 2, and this is 15 AP 2442, right?
Yes, correct.
And 2442 was initiated by an original complaint filed on November 30th, 2015, correct?
Following the bifurcation of those five counts out of NORA 1, where an attempt was made to amend in 2014.
Do you have an order showing the bifurcation? I guess that's what I'm missing.
Your Honor, what occurred was the referee in NORA 1 declined to allow OLR to amend, and that was the order. And then OLR commenced NORA 2, and it was assigned to a different referee. So when I use the expression bifurcated, I simply mean that it was taken out of NORA 1 and placed into NORA 2.
Okay. So my understanding is that your complaint is, with respect to due process, is about the second amended complaint in NORA 2. Is that right?
It is. My complaint is about the entire proceeding in NORA 2 because I was never allowed to be heard on my motion to dismiss for selective and vindictive prosecution.
Okay, hang on. So my understanding was that your due process complaint is that the allegations in the second amended complaint in 2442 did not go before a preliminary review committee.
As far as I can tell, whatever was taken to the preliminary review committee was so inaccurate it did not present the actual documents in the Spencer case, but was relying entirely on a Seventh Circuit decision down in 2014.
I'm just looking at the procedural aspect.
Sure.
Right. So the original complaint in 2442, that followed from a preliminary review committee determination. Is that correct?
I don't know if that's true.
Okay.
I do know that if there was a preliminary review committee determination, that it was not based on the documents that should have been reviewed by OLR before it was presented for charging. I was denied discovery in NORA 2, so that's why I'm not sure.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, before you start your presentation, perhaps you could just walk us through the procedural aspects so we understand the relationship between NORA 1 and NORA 2 with respect to what went through the preliminary review committee.
I will do that first by a matter of introduction. My name is Paul Schwarzenbart. May it please the Court, I am honored to appear here today representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation in this proceeding as its retained counsel. To address your question, Justice Kelly, I was a little late to this game because I was appointed successor counsel to counsel who initiated both NORA 1 and NORA 2. That occurred in either April or May. I think it was March of 2016. I think I appeared in NORA 1 because that was about a month before trial. My understanding is that what happened was that the background to NORA 1 was presented to the Preliminary Review Committee in 2013, and cause to proceed was provided. The complaint in NORA 1 was filed based on the cause to proceed determination. There was later a motion to amend NORA 1 to include the counts that became NORA 2, but that occurred only after a separate presentation to the Preliminary Review Committee in 2015, where cause to proceed was provided with respect to the five counts that are presented in NORA 2. So what happened was there was an attempt by OLR to join all these grievances into one proceeding rather than having separate proceedings. And referee Goldman in that case denied the motion to amend, which was made, I think, late in 2015. If I recall correctly from reading the decision by referee Goldman, it was primarily on the basis that this case is already 2 years old. We don't want to further delay taking this case to trial. So you, OLR, need to file a separate action if you want to proceed on these other counts.
Okay. So there's no motion to bifurcate. There's no order bifurcating.
No, there is not. There is simply a decision and order denying a motion for leave to amend.
Counsel, the record in this case seems to grow like topsy. Every time we turn around, there's another stack of materials. Yesterday, I came in to re-review everything that I thought I was set to have to discern, and I found this packet at my door on a Sunday morning. And it is a motion to take judicial notice of numerous documents. Have you been served with such a motion and the documents?
From time to time, I've been served with large numbers of documents by Ms. Nora asking the court to take judicial notice of all kinds of things. I didn't receive one this morning before I came here today. So if one was delivered to my office this morning, I have not seen it.
Okay. Well, it may be that... it arrived on my doorstep yesterday, and I can't tell you exactly when it was filed. My question to you was going to be, do you object to the courts taking judicial notice of the court documents that Attorney Nora included with, I think, the most recent, I wasn't familiar with an earlier one, motion to take judicial notice?
Let me address, having not seen the documents, if they were delivered this morning, it's hard for me to comment on that. But in general, the position that the OLR has taken with respect to Attorney Nora's request for judicial notice is we're generally not objecting to those.
Okay.
Directly, if we have objections to them, we're doing it in the briefing. Because
okay.
Every time we take up a process issue with Attorney Nora, we manufacture thousands of more pages in this case. It's pointless. Most of the time, the things that she's filing are genuine copies. Whether or not they're relevant is really the issue, and that's something we've addressed.
Right, and we don't address relevance. I think she's asking us to take judicial notice that these are court documents. As I look at what's been provided to me, I think I can't really tell exactly when these were filed, but they all are or appear to be court documents that have something to do with Attorney Nora and the matters that are now before us. So if it becomes important for the court to know whether you object or you don't object, I guess we'll have to take that up at another time. I thought we might be able to deal with it with a simple answer: if OLR doesn't object, they don't object, and then we don't worry about addressing the motion more fully.
Well, let me make the following suggestion, Chief Justice, that if there's something new that was filed that I find about when I return to the office, and if the OLR has concerns as to authenticity or that there's some new issue that's attempted to be raised through these, we would advise that the court of that in a letter copied to Ms. Nora, of course.
Okay. That seems reasonable. Thank you.
I think Your Honor's note about how this case grows exponentially mirrors what my opening statement was going to be regarding this case. This is a simple case, notwithstanding the fact that I think in my office this case grew to 8 or 9 banker's boxes worth of materials. This is a simple case. The issues are whether and to what extent this court should impose discipline for Attorney Nora's conduct in two matters, the Spencer and Rinaldi matters, where she was sanctioned by the federal courts for frivolous litigation. That's what this case is all about. In the Spencer matter, the conduct at issue occurred both in state and in federal court. In the Rinaldi matter, there was a state court proceeding, but the subject of discipline really is related to Ms. Nora's conduct in the federal bankruptcy court and in appeals from bankruptcy court and district court decisions in that case. So the Rinaldi matter, the state court matter, is more of a backdrop. It's not directly relevant to the misconduct. Under this court's well-established authority in the Lauer case going back to 1982 and the more recent Wadooly case in 2003, what we have in a situation such as this is the disciplinary case is not a forum to relitigate the underlying findings of frivolousness. The issues here relate to Ms. Nora's state of mind and a burden of proof, which is clear and convincing evidence rather than the lower burden of proof. Those are the differences between the underlying findings of frivolousness and what the court needs to find in this case. I listened carefully to Ms. Nora's argument here today, and it really bears little resemblance to an ordinary argument on an appeal. I didn't hear any arguments being made about erroneous findings of fact. I didn't hear any arguments being made about erroneous conclusions of law. I didn't hear any arguments being made about abuse of discretion, which are the normal issues for review. So when Ms. Nora briefed this case, she identified 18 issues. And in responding, trying to put some order into the chaos, we addressed them as five different types of arguments. And that's where I'd like to go here today. There's been a lot of talk about due process, and part of that relates to OLR's cross-appeal regarding counts 1 and 4. But the first two due process issues, and there's been attention devoted to these today, this morning, relate to the role of the Preliminary Review Committee. Two comments on that. The first and simple answer to Ms. Nora's complaints about due process violations and the Preliminary Review Committee is that due process doesn't apply to proceedings before the PRC. The PRC is not a grand jury. It's not a quasi-judicial proceeding where evidence is presented and there's a decision made. Preliminary Review Committee is simply part of the lawyer regulation system. There's nothing in the Supreme Court rules in Chapter 21 or Chapter 22 that provide for any type of contested hearing before the Preliminary Review Committee. The function that the Preliminary Review Committee serves really is to basically provide input and a filtering to the director of the Office of Lawyer Regulation that forces the OLR to go through the process of preparing an investigative report and submitting it to this separate committee, which looks at the report and decides, do you have cause to proceed here or not? It's a check on the filing process. It's nothing more than that. And in the Donald Eisenberg case back in 1994, very similar issues were presented to this court. That was under the prior regulatory system with the Board of Appeals. But under the prior rules, the BAPR essentially served the same function as the PRC does here. And Attorney Eisenberg in that case complained that he should have been allowed to present evidence and make argument to the PRC. And this court's answer was, there is no right under the rules, there is no constitutional right to appear before the BAPR at that time to contest the issue whether or not the BAPR should go forward with disciplinary charges. The opportunity for due process is triggered when the complaint is filed in this proceeding. This court appoints a referee with the powers of a circuit court judge to try the case as a civil action before the court, and then all of the procedural protections required by due process are afforded to any respondent in a disciplinary proceeding, including Ms. Nora. So that's the first answer. The second issue of due process that Ms. Nora has raised relates to the amendment to the complaint and her argument in her brief, which I haven't heard about today, where she contends that because in our post-hearing brief we had 174 numbered paragraphs summarizing the evidence, that due process required that those 174 paragraphs be submitted to the PRC for its approval before we could proceed with this court reaching a decision on the charges. That argument is patently absurd. And I would note, and I don't believe it's been discussed specifically, but Supreme Court Rule 22.11 sub 5 specifically provides for amendments to complaints after a complaint is filed by the OLR. In this case, The amendment that was made, the final amendment to NORA 2 complaint, was made after I got in the case. And the amendment occurred because when I read the complaint, I noticed a mistake. And that was that at paragraph 6 of the complaint, it referred to the Spencer foreclosure action in state court as case number 2013 TJ49. And when I'm not serving as OLR's retained counsel, I do commercial litigation. I know what TJ stands for, but apparently the folks at the OLR didn't pick up on that mistake. And when Attorney Nora returned her responses to discovery, what I learned was she was basically refusing to provide any answers to the discovery questions based on the fact that they related to case number 2013 TJ49, and by gosh, I never did anything in case number 2013 TJ49. And when I saw that, I attempted to do what lawyers are supposed to do. I contacted Ms. Nora and I said, you understand this was an error. Will you answer the discovery understanding it's directed to case number 2009 CV-283, because that was the case that Attorney Nora appeared in Wood County. Ms. Nora predictably refused to do so. So at that point, I filed a motion with the referee asking for alternative relief. Number one, either deem the complaint amended and direct Attorney Nora to respond to the discovery with the understanding it referred to the Spencer foreclosure case, or number two, that we get to amend the complaint to fix this patent Scrivener's error. The referee opted for the latter relief and directed that the complaint be amended to fix that error. And there was another error going to paragraph 19. It was simply my effort in looking through what I inherited from the OLR to have a better understanding of what Ms. Nora was accusing Judge Potter of when she claimed that there had been three prior instances of ex parte communication. That was the only other clarification that was done by way of amendment at that point. These are simply examples of how everything Attorney Nora touches gets over-litigated to a degree beyond anything that is remotely reasonable.
Counsel, you indicated that due process doesn't kick in until the complaint is filed. What if in a complaint that's filed tomorrow, the OLR did not follow its procedures and did not submit the complaint to a preliminary review committee?
Well, I think the OLR director would not be doing his job and following the rules if he did that. I would note that there's nothing in the pleadings that requires the OLR to plead compliance with the process of going through PRC approval.
Sometimes we have cases where entities don't follow their own procedural rules. Can that rise to a level of a due process violation?
Well, actually, I don't believe it does, and I would base my argument on that on a case I actually briefed before this court back in 1989. It was an inmate case, Staples versus Young, I believe the citation was 149 Wiz Second, where the Court of Appeals in that case had concluded that Mr. Staples had been denied due process and had a basis for a claim under 42 U.S. Code Section 3 because he had not had his inmate complaint responded to within 35 days as required by administrative rules. And we argued to this court that that was not something that was a due process. It was not a substantive due process right protected by the Constitution.
Former Justice Bablich would use this phrase, statutory due process, which would encompass administrative regulations, and find that as a violation that is subject to remedy.
There has been much debate about the concept of substantive due process over the years, and I think that the latest word from the U.S. Supreme Court and the Seventh Circuit on it is it's a very, very narrow concept, which I don't think would apply here. And as far as procedural due process is concerned, I think that the authorities of the U.S. Supreme Court, as recognized by this court, are that due process means that a respondent or a defendant has one opportunity for a full and a fair hearing. And the point is, the one full and fair opportunity is to defend the case after it's filed with this court and after it's referred to the referee. That due process doesn't kick in at this pre-filing stage where the OLR is following the procedures mandated by this court's rules that require it to proceed with getting PRC approval before filing a complaint.
Counsel, what's your best argument that SCR 20:3.1 has been fully complied with in the pleadings?
That goes to our cross appeal on the due process issue, and I think the arguments there, Your Honor, are we've set them out in our brief. But our basic argument is that the complaint, which did not specify a subsection of the rule, should have been understood to have been pleading a violation of any or all subsections of the rule. That's notice. The notice only needs to be sufficient to put the respondent on, to give them fair notice of what is being alleged. I didn't draft the complaint originally. I didn't take it upon myself to ferret it out into subsections when I took over the case. If I had to guess, the reason that subsections weren't pleaded in the case is because the frivolous findings really came from the Seventh Circuit, which didn't make those kinds of distinctions when it sanctioned Ms. Nora in both the Spencer case and in the Rinaldi case for her misconduct. But the point is, if the complaint pled 3.1 sub A, fair notice to Ms. Nora is that I'm being accused of potentially violating any of the subsections, and my backup on that is to point out, as we did in our brief, that in her responsive pleadings, Ms. Nora clearly understood this, because she denied violating each and every subsection of 3.1A.
So isn't there a difference, though, counsel, between potentially forfeiting the claim because she did just that and said, I'm not, you know, her response and her not raising it? Isn't there a difference between that and your obligation to still allege it? I mean, how would she know which subsection you were proceeding under? How would she assume it was potentially all three? And why should we say that that's okay, that you don't have to specify?
Well, first of all, Ms. Nora never raised this issue on her own.
Right.
She denied violating all three. So my point would be, how has she been harmed by this? Well, she's denying all three of them. So she knows, if she's denying all three, she must know that she's potentially been charged with all three.
That's kind of a distinction between whether you have an obligation to give notice or whether or not she actually raised the issue of not getting due process, right?
Yep, well.
Is your position you don't, like, going forward, if you were to file a complaint, is it your position you don't have to specify which subsection someone is being alleged to have violated?
Well, I can't speak for the OLR because I'm only retained counsel. I don't know if they have made a policy determination whether it's better going forward to plead a specific subsection or not. My guess is that since it's come up in this case and had come up in one prior case, that maybe the better practice is to do that, but better practice doesn't mean due process violation. They're not necessarily one and the same thing. If it helps the referees do their job, which I think was the frustration of the referee here, as it was in the prior case, I think the Bach case where he had raised this issue, you know, maybe it's the better practice, but does this rise to a level of due process where Attorney Nora was not given adequate notice of the misconduct that she had already been found by the Seventh Circuit to have committed in these cases? I don't believe it rises to a due process violation. Certainly not one that was prejudicial to her in any way. And You know, I do want to address one other issue because the referee did raise it and Ms. Nora has raised it in a number of her briefs, and this was the U.S. Supreme Court case in Ruffalo, R-U-F-F-A-L-O, 390 U.S. 544. The Ruffalo case did involve a situation where a new charge was raised after the pleadings were completed and during the trial. That's not what happened here. What happened here is the OLR got caused to proceed on five counts. They proceeded on five counts, the same five counts, through an amendment and then a second amendment to the complaint in this case. There was not a new charge that was made against Attorney Nora in violation of due process. This case is not remotely close to the Ruffalo case. Turning back to what are the issues on this appeal, in her brief, Ms. Nora seems to take issue with some of the findings of fact. I have not heard anything here today other than her belief, I think, that the referee went too far in finding that her conduct was deserving of the severity of the sanction that he recommended in this case because she believes she was acting in good faith in defending people whose homes were being foreclosed. The problem here is that Ms. Nora is a serial offender who seems to be unwilling, unable to ever accept the finality of any judicial decision in any case. And that is why the referee found, and I think he explains it pretty well through about 10 pages of text toward the close of the report. That's why the referee found that Attorney Nora is a danger to the public, because every issue is going to be over-litigated. The judges are going to be accused of misconduct. The opposing counsel are going to be accused of misconduct.
Counsel, the danger to the public, of course, is language that we see in other kinds of proceedings. For instance, in Chapter 51, mental commitment cases. That's pretty strong language. Where do you draw the line between I think of Thomas Paine. Thomas Paine was a Paine.
Stipulated.
Okay. Was he a danger to the public?
To the loyalists, I suppose he was.
Yeah, but I mean, people have the right to have lots of different opinions, to challenge authority, to be disliked, to be disdained, as in Thomas Paine. Does that make him a danger to the public? He's serving the public.
Well, let me address what the public is here. The public is the public that pays the taxes that support the judicial system, which has to devote resources to Ms. Nora's cases far in excess of what should be devoted to these types of cases. The public is also the people who are the investors who have been forgotten, as Ms. Nora talks about. She makes her political speech about residential foreclosure cases. She's overlooking the fact that investors who were unfortunately brought into securitized mortgages lost a lot of money here, and the longer that a foreclosure case can be drawn out with frivolous defenses that force the banks to incur more and more expenses defending frivolous motions and disputing frivolous defenses, that part of the public also sustains an injury. This isn't a one-dimensional thing. It also injures the public in the sense that it endangers the public's trust in the judicial system and in the judiciary. I mean, I've quoted these comments that Ms. Nora made at pages, in the Spencer case in particular, at pages 4 and 5 of our brief, where she accuses opposing counsel of making multiple fraudulent filings. She refers to an actual pattern and practice by Judge Potter and opposing counsel of acting in concert to effectuate a fraudulent foreclosure, against Sheila M. Spencer and her home. She refers to Judge Potter and opposing counsel collaborating, engaging in ex parte communications. The allegations were untrue. She never made any attempt to actually prove them. All they did was they were thrown out there to effect a delay. Then a frivolous removal was made to federal court, again to effect a delay. Judge Crabb found that the recusal or that the removal was unfounded, which is the closest thing to frivolous you can get. It was found frivolous by the Seventh Circuit eventually. But what happens when Judge Crabb rules against Ms. Nora? She gets called all kinds of things as well, and we've summarized those in our brief as well. And what do we have from Ms. Nora today? She half-heartedly, and years later, expresses some remorse for what she calls performance deficiencies. That is grossly minimizing, if not denying, the misconduct that she engaged in these underlying cases. This court should not tolerate this type of conduct within the judicial system. It undermines the system. It undermines public confidence in the system. It encourages the bringing of frivolous defenses and bringing frivolous motions because there's no consequences for them. The Spencer case went on for years after Ms. Nora got involved in it. The Rinaldi case, now both of these started before Ms. Nora got involved, admittedly. And my guess is she took on clients who were of a like mind with her. The Rinaldi case, I think, from beginning to end, it's going on 10 years since there was an initial foreclosure filed and Ms. Nora got on the case in 2011. That's what's going on in these cases. It's not a good faith defense of residential foreclosure cases. And Ms. Nora, in her testimony, refused to admit that any of the judges were correct. She testified Judge Kelly was wrong, Judge Stadtmuller was wrong, the Seventh Circuit was wrong. She claimed they misinterpreted this court's decision in the PHH case, and Ms. Nora is actually wrong because the PHH, in the PHH case, and subsequently in a more recent decision, this court said the only thing that matters in these foreclosure cases is possession of the ink-signed originals. Ms. Nora refuses to accept that decision and persists in advancing frivolous defenses in these cases. She doesn't accept the decision. She moves for reconsideration. She moves for reconsideration a second time. She appeals frivolously. That's what's going on in these cases. And I think that's the concern that the referee had in this case when he recommended a 2-year extension of the original 1-year suspension of Attorney Nora's license in Nora 1, because we do see a continuation of the same type of misconduct that the court saw in the Nora 1 case. And again, going back farther, it's the same type of conduct from the Minnesota disciplinary case that led to sanctions in 1993. Thank you, Your Honors. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
Thank you. Mr. Schwarzenbart misstated the record in response to the question of what the procedures were. He did not discover on his own that the pleadings in the Nora 1 amended complaint, which was pending when he took over, were in error. It was as a result of the discovery I had commenced. It was not my response to any discovery that OLR had propounded. They hadn't propounded any discovery yet. What he discovered from my discovery was that I was specifically asking, what evidence do you have to support the allegations in counts 1, 2, and 3? Because that related back to my concern that the preliminary review panel had not received all exculpatory evidence, which is required under this court's rule for a fair determination as to whether cause to proceed exists. So that is just wrong, that I had been given discovery which I was refusing to respond to. I never refused to respond to any discovery whatsoever. Now, also, Mr. Schwarzenbart, I think misheard Judge Ann Walsh Bradley's question regarding statutory due process. He answered it in the context of substantive due process. I have not raised an issue of substantive due process. I am aware of that standard, although my conscience is sometimes shocked by the level of hostility toward my practice displayed by OLR. That is not the same thing as shocking the conscience for purposes of constitutionally violative substantive due process. Paragraph 19 of the Second Amended Complaint poses a really significant issue, and that is, this was the allegation of where I had tried to inform Judge Potter that there were false documents being presented in the court. OLR's convenient way of writing around its lack of initial investigation to even attempt to understand where I was coming from in setting forth concerns about ex parte communications with Judge Potter simply took my response, my presentation of discovery to learn that they didn't ever look at the record before I was charged. And this was really important because I had framed my defense based on OLR's noncompliance with SCR 22.11. I had denied it by motions to dismiss and by proposals to litigate that issue. So it was all an attack on my defense. Now, Chief Justice, I did not file anything into this case since April. Okay. I don't know where that came from.
Okay. Well, it may be that it arrived on my doorstep later, but I think Attorney Schwarzenbach's comment that if he hasn't seen them and if there's any objection from OLR, he will write the court and copy you. So I think that's a reasonable way of taking care of it.
Yes, but what concerns me is that this court would receive something so terribly late and not be aware what the date is. I have no idea what that document is.
I read it all, and I'm sure my colleagues did too. The filings in this case have been rather voluminous, and it just may be that our staff was not able to get to them earlier. I got it yesterday when I came in on Sunday to catch up.
But. And in fact, on October 22nd, I received notice of electronic filing of my reply brief and appendix. So that might be what you received. But in any event, these cases are voluminous. They involve details of commercial practices and pleadings that are extensive. And Mr. Schwarzenbach thinks that I don't respect the courts. I respect the courts' ability to put a stop to false pleadings and fraudulent foreclosure. I still hold out that confidence to this day. I have not been the one who has been able to persuade the courts of the state of Wisconsin, but it is certainly not a matter of my disrespecting the court, any court. It's my desire for the courts to recognize that frauds are being committed in judicial foreclosure cases. With respect to the Rinaldis, their case was brought by a party who we can show did not have the note and mortgage conveyed to it, that it was in another entity that is currently before this court on petition for review on my behalf as an intervener to enforce my mortgagee interest. And with Spencer, the issue was, is this a Freddie Mac mortgage as opposed to PNC acting in its, on its own behalf? And my exhibit that I, for all the exhibits I tried to get in, the 1098A clearly shows that this was a Freddie Mac mortgage, that federal jurisdiction would have existed but for the false pleadings that initiated that case.
Counsel, speak to me about the violation of the attorney oath.
Oh, Your Honor. Yes, I didn't get to go into that as much as I had wanted.
There's a lot in the attorney's oath, and one is, I will not maintain any suit or proceeding which shall appear to be unjust. There's another, I will abstain from all offensive personality. What are they targeting you with?
Oh, well, Your Honor, the excerpts of the attorney's oath that appeared in a footnote I was going to get to the unjust, to taking any action that was, I believe, to be unjust. I, in good faith, don't believe that defending homeowners on provable facts or facts that can be discovered in discovery is an unjust cause. But I think my personality has been offensive. I have been overzealous, and that is a repeat of behavior in which I engaged in 1993 during the agricultural crisis of the 1980s. And it is a flaw in my character, but I have to tell the court that for my practice from 1990 until 2008, which is a span of 28 years, I did not display this kind of overzealous zeal. Okay, that's redundant. Okay, so the I guess what you would say, almost a political orientation that I've tried to avoid. And I don't think that Mr. Schwarzenbart understands securitization to this day. The investors are not harmed because they've all been paid off, which we can prove if we ever could get into discovery and summary judgment. But it is heartbreaking to see thousands of people lose their homes when the pleadings can be shown to be false, or the documents recorded in the public record can be shown to be false. An individual was convicted of filing 1 million false documents through her company in the public records. It's something where if I could do it over again, I would check my zealousness at the door and try to be much more peaceable in my observations, because we can only know what we can know at the time that we know it. That is, once a court is shown evidence from which the conclusion can be drawn, these documents are false, then the court is accountable. I believe the counsel in these cases had that evidence and ignored it. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, once again, thank you for very spirited arguments on both sides. To say the briefing was extensive is a huge understatement, but the court, you can be assured, has read everything that's been filed. So we will take the matter under advisement, and we are now adjourned until 1:30 for our third argument of the day. Thank you.